Okay, we proceed with the next case is Mary Salinger versus Brian Oakes. Mr. Lang.
May it please the court, my name is James Lang. I'm one of the assistant corporation counsels for the city of Springfield, Illinois, and I'm representing the officers. This case is before the court today on the interlocutory appeal of the denial of qualified immunity for Zimmerman, Oakes, and Oliver. In discussing the court's decision in McKinney, this court does indeed have jurisdiction over this. The defendants are not in any way disputing for purposes of their qualified immunity that the facts as found by the district court. We don't agree with them, but even if we take these facts as true, the officer should still be entitled to qualified immunity based on the struggle that occurred and the subsequent death of Mr. Salinger. The court found basically that there was four issues that prevented the application of the qualified immunity for the officers. They involved the blow to the head, the blows after Mr. Salinger was already handcuffed, the hobbling of Mr. Salinger, and the failure to position him properly after he was hobbled. Based on the court's findings that those could possibly be not reasonable from the officer's perspective, she found that there was a qualified immunity did not apply. And the court really failed to properly analyze the situation. Judge Scott made these findings a fact and then basically said, well, it's standard black letter law that excessive force is prohibited, and therefore we need to go to trial and find out if these factual issues are found by the jury to be excessive. She failed to provide any actual on-point discussion of the case law that would have put the officers on notice that their conduct during this situation was unconstitutional.
Well, she held that there was a factual dispute as to whether Andrew was handcuffed and had stopped trying to move or kick before the officers hobbled him. And also as to whether closed fist blows and blows with flashlights occurred after that point as well. Now, when you take those facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, can you really argue that it isn't clearly established law that the officers can't hobble up handcuffed person who is no longer resisting, or that they can't repeatedly strike such a person?
Well, actually, the case of Garrett in Georgia found the facts are very similar.
You mean that district court case? The district court case?
No, that was actually an appellate court case, I believe. But that case basically shows that the whole issue of hobbling and positioning and such is still completely...
Yeah, it's circuit court, I'm sorry.
Okay. It is still completely up in the air. And in that case, they actually found that he had been hobbled after he had quit struggling, and the court... quite clearly said that it's not necessarily a violation of his rights when they take the opportunity during a momentary lull in what was a very protracted and violent struggle to make sure that they have secured him. And this is exactly the same situation we have here. There was evidence that he had stopped struggling momentarily at least a couple times before that. But he had always started right back up. To say that the officers are on notice that anytime someone stops momentarily, they have to assume that everything's under control and put their lives at risk again by not properly securing him, there just isn't any case law to that effect.
Garrett's quite a different case, though, isn't it? You've got a high-speed chase. You've got roadblocks here, there, and everywhere to catch him. He hits a mailbox. He goes into a ditch. The chase continues. I mean, it's, you know, he rams the police officer's patrol cars. I mean,
well, the facts leading up to the final struggle are a little bit different, but the actual fact is that these officers, Salinger was the aggressor. He, committed an assault on the police officer to start the entire thing, and then he never once gave up and completely quit struggling until basically he died. And the officers actually used very proper through the continuum of force. They start off with the pepper spray. That wasn't effective. They tried arm bar holds. They tried pressure point techniques. And gradually, the force increased and increased to the point where he had to be handcuffed, he had to be hobbled, and they acted with what seemed to be completely appropriate responses to the continued aggression of Andrew Salinger.
Regard to the hobble, was this who owned the hobble? Sergeant, Salinger? What was the name of the officer that owned the hobble?
The hobble was actually owned by Officer Oakes.
Oakes.
It was a privately owned piece of equipment.
I was confused about that. Who went and got that? It was Zimmerman went and got it, right?
Zimmerman went and got it.
So who had the, whatever expertise there was with regard to the hobble?
Oakes is the one who had it, who received the instructions and would have known how to apply it. He was the one who was trying to restrain Salinger's feet during the struggle.
Who would have known that he should have been put on his side?
Zimmerman testified that he needed to be put on. He knew that he needed to be put on his side.
No, okay. And Oakes is the one who said he read the instructions and knew how to use a hobble?
Right.
I was confused about who is more up on use of a hobble. It was not a policy of the department at that time. This was something extracurricular that I guess Oakes went and got on his own.
He bought it on his own. The department allowed the use of hobbles but didn't supply them as standard equipment.
Okay. And so the question I guess I have is if the use of the hobble, just using one and then abusing it, the use of it would be, I guess there's nothing that says, or no pre-existing law or clearly established that you cannot use a hobble, period. Is that correct?
Right. There is nothing to say that.
But as far as how you use it, was it Zimmerman is the one that knew that he should be laying on his side?
That's correct.
And there's this disputed evidence about, I guess Zimmerman said he was already on his side. The other two said he was not.
Right.
So that, I just wanted to bifurcate that. That seems to be a question that is yet to be resolved.
It is, but the fact is that the case law in regard to hobbles and positioning and all that is not clearly established at the time of this incident. In fact, I still don't think it is today based on the Garrett case, that there are instances where it's appropriate to use. There are instances, there's even conflicting medical evidence about whether or not these hobbles can actually cause death if they're misused or if the people are not properly positioned, and that's all discussed in some of the cases that deal with these issues regarding hobbles.
But I'm just looking at the facts that we have that are not disputed. The fact is they used the hobble, and there's a disputed fact about whether or not he was face down or laying on his side.
Right. But the the case law is not clear on these issues, and even if we take the fact that he wasn't immediately turned over, there's a question as to whether or not the officers had any reason to know that their actions were going to violate a clearly established constitutional right. And the same would also go for the blow to the head, for which there's very little evidence, but we're not going to talk about the sufficiency of it, but assuming that there was a blow to the head, And assuming that he was struck, and it's very clear that he was struck after he was handcuffed, the officers testified that they did that because he was continuing to resist and reach for Officer Oliver's duty belt. So plaintiffs have provided no evidence that any of those items are clearly established by the law.
And when you started out, you recited four different bases for the judge's decision. As I recall,
the blow to the head, the blows after he was handcuffed.
It was not a Hobble case. I mean,
no, it's not just the Hobble case. There actually are the four issues, but there is nothing provided by plaintiff to show that those other issues are clearly established by the law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Kleczek?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Counselor. My name is David Kleczek, and I represent Mary Salinger, the estate of Andrew Salinger, her son and decedent. This case is here on a denial of qualified immunity, amongst other issues, on summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff and against the defendants. The defendant has appealed. When we received the appeal, we filed a motion to dismiss based on lack of jurisdiction, citing the Johnson case. When I received the order 2 days ago relating to McKinney, I thought it was directed just to me. It's obvious it was directed to everybody. But I think that the McKinney case is directly on point, in that in McKinney there was a motion to dismiss based on lack of jurisdiction. In this case, there's a motion to dismiss based on lack of jurisdiction. And the point we wanted to make was that in the defendant's brief, they take issue with many of the facts found to be in dispute by Judge Scott. And it's clear in McKinney that this court does not sit to review those facts, but only sits to take the facts as found by the district court and determine whether qualified immunity issue applies.
Yeah, but they're not asking us to review them, are they? They're just telling us they don't like them.
Today they're not asking you to review them in oral argument. It was my understanding from reading the brief that that they did ask us to assume things. That, for example, Andrew Salinger was handcuffed and hogtied. The evidence shows he was struck in the head, a subdural hematoma, struck in the head by a flashlight, a mag light, with a full force. And there is an issue of fact as to when that occurred. If that occurred after he was, definitely if that occurred after he was hogtied or hobbled, if that occurred after he was handcuffed and on his stomach, that is a violation of a clearly established right, and no reasonable officer would strike a handcuffed individual on his stomach with three officers in the room with a flashlight. It is deadly force, and the only time an officer is to use deadly force is when there is the threat of serious physical harm to the officer or others. That's just one of the findings of fact that Judge Scott made, was that there was a blow to the head and there's an issue of fact as to when that blow occurred. Judge Scott, on page 45 of her opinion, said there's a material fact with respect to the timing and the amount of the force used by the officers and the reasonableness of the force used. So what Judge Scott said is, looking at this evidence, looking at the depositions, looking at the discrepancies. Now, remember, Andrew Salinger is my client. He is the only one to tell his side of the story. He's not here. He passed away. We're looking at discrepancies of the three officers, and Judge Scott said, based on the discrepancies of the evidence, the physical evidence, Officer Hsu, the crime scene investigator's evidence, there is discrepancies as to how much force was used and when it was used. Judge Scott said an issue of fact exists as to whether the officers properly positioned Andrew Salinger after hobbling. That's page 44. An issue of fact exists as to whether Andrew Salinger was still struggling when the hobble was applied, and whether he was still struggling when full force flashlight punches and closed fist punches were applied. That's page 44 of Judge Scott's opinion. Questions of fact exist regarding the degree of control the officers had over Andrew Salinger when they administered these punches, and this is important. She said, Judge Scott said, Zimmerman, the officer in charge of the scene, Sergeant Zimmerman, left the room. Now, we have to remember, we're inside Andrew Salinger, the decedent's home, inside his bedroom. There's three 200-plus police officers, one naked, mentally disturbed individual inside his own home. An altercation occurs. They get him handcuffed. Zimmerman leaves the room. What Judge Scott said was that under those circumstances, there's an issue of fact of whether the officers were in fear for their own safety and the degree of control they had over the decedent.
And that the fact that he left meant things were under control, or he just had to get the mace or whatever it was, pepper spray, out of his eyes?
The fact that he left, and his reason for leaving was, to what he said, to get pepper spray out of his eyes. But Judge Scott said the fact that he left raises an issue of fact as to the degree of control the officers had over Andrew Salinger. And, Your Honors, the fact is that we assume that these facts are true for today's purpose of qualified immunity. And there is no question that that under these facts, no reasonable officer, there was a clearly established right on behalf of Andrew Salinger, constitutional right to be free from these acts that we are assuming that the officers performed.
Are you wanting us to hold that it was clearly established that officers could not hogtie or hobble a person who was mentally disturbed? Is that what you want?
I believe the Abdul-Hali case is instructive and on point. That's the Wisconsin individual that was running in traffic in Madison. And that case is also similar. Three police officers, Abdul-Hali was a mentally ill individual, bipolar schizophrenic, just as Andrew Salinger was. It was outside on the expressway. Three officers tackled him, and they put pressure on his back. And the evidence in the Abdul-Hali case showed that...
You want to stand in front of the mic or we won't have the
sure,
recording.
Okay. I'm sorry. Abdul-Hali had died of positional asphyxiation, lack of oxygen to the heart. We have a similar situation in this case. On page 14 of Judge Scott's opinion, she found that when Sergeant Zimmerman returned with Oaks Hobble, Andrew's torso was on the bed, and Oliver was partially on his bed with his right knee on his shoulder area.
I'm going to interrupt you because your time is fleeing.
Okay.
What's the answer to my question? Is it yes or no?
It is under these circumstances that the application and positioning of the Hobble and Andrew Salinger was unconstitutional because he was mentally ill, because they had put pressure on his back, and because they continued with the inappropriate use of force.
Forgive me, but that isn't my question.
Okay.
My question is, do you want us to hold that it was clearly established at the time all of this occurred that police officers could not hogtie or hobble a person who was mentally disturbed? Was it clearly established? That's my question.
Under those bare facts, no.
Okay.
With additional facts, such as what we have in this case, I believe the answer is yes.
Yeah, it wasn't clear that the victim in that other case was psychotic, as I recall. I recall the other case pretty vividly.
There was some question.
Yeah.
whether that individual was psychotic. There, in our case, there was no question. When the officers arrived on scene, one of the officers admitted that the family had said he's bipolar, schizophrenic, he's not taking his medication. It was 1:30 in the morning. He was running around his house naked, talking about colors and fishing and chasing the cat. There was no question that Andrew Salinger was mentally disturbed, and the officers had actual knowledge. It wasn't due to drug use. It wasn't due to alcohol. It was because of a mental disability. Your Honors, I thank you for your time in this matter, and that's all I have today.
Okay, thanks. The time here. I guess your time's expired. Okay. Thanks to both.